Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth and Movies. I'm David Jenkins.
I'm Marina Shodi.
And I'm Hafa Sellers Ross.
A Moroccan holiday goes south for Ralph Fiennes and Jessica Chastain in John Martin McDonagh's The Forgiven. Tilda Swinton has a slightly more successful weekend in Istanbul with Idris Elba in 3,000 Years of Longing. And on Film Club this week, we're taking another peep at Pier Paolo Pasolini's bawdy 1974 epic, Arabian Nights. All coming up on Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Hafa, first time into the podcast, welcome. I understand you are currently in more exotic climes than the meeting rooms of TCO London in Shoreditch.
Yes, so I am speaking to you guys straight from the Venice Film Festival. I am so thrilled to be joining today. I listen to this every week, so I'm very excited. And if you hear some background noise, it's because I am sat right next to the very busy lifts of the Palazzo.
Ah, yes. and you're also recording on your AirPods due to for tech tech reasons. So yeah, that's why your audio might be a little bit muffled, but you know, that's the kind of risk we want to take to get some cool on the ground reportage from the Venice Film Festival. So but yeah, are you having an all right time over there? What have you seen so far?
It's very hard to have a bad time in Venice, to be fair. I think even if the only thing I was allowed to watch here was repeats of 13 Reasons Why, I would still fairly enjoy myself. So it is great to be here. It's only day two. So yesterday we had White Noise. I was fairly lukewarm on that. And then we had the Lars von Trier TV show, which is always an experience, and Cate Blanchett and Tar, very, very good. I have just come out of Bardo, which so far from the people I spoke to, I seem to be the most enthusiastic on, but maybe it's because I am also Latina, identify with the diaspora, but yeah, I quite like that. So I'm very looking forward to
it. So that's the new film from Alessandro Iñárritu, yes.
He is not always a favorite of mine. When I love his films, I love them, and when I don't, I hate them. It was quite the experience, and I think I'll need a couple more hours to start digesting it. But yeah, but
and you're gonna, I understand you're gonna be reviewing that one for Little White Lies. So this is your. So I think when this pod goes out, we're recording in that point where just before you actually write your review. But by the time people hear this pod, your review will actually be out there. So there's going to be a weird kind of time delay, and people will know more about what you think if they've gone to the Little White Lies website.
Yeah, it's half in the Bardo of the Little White Lies multiverse.
Indeed. and hey there, Marina. This is your second pod, I believe.
Yes, hello.
And all well with you?
Yes, all good.
So I wanted to, I guess for this week, the films that we're covering, and I think purely by chance, or maybe a bit by our kind of Machiavellian setting up of the selections. I guess all the films this week, Forgiven, 3,000 Years of Longing, Arabian Nights, they're all films, they're all stories set in Middle East and North Africa. And they're all films directed by white men. So it's that this, we're getting these interpretations of Orientalism and African culture and the mythic, you know, the sort of mythical culture of the region. Marina, what have you having seen all the films, are you seeing a kind of positive connectivity there, or are you seeing some questionable stuff that we could maybe get into later when we cover the films?
I mean, it's this interesting thing that you see in Hollywood mostly, where Africa is kind of seen as like incapable of modernity, whereas Islam is seen as completely resistant to it, and kind of how white directors use that space, that not only white directors, you see it in cinema, you see it in literature, you see it in art history, where they just take this space, either a space of corruption and backwardness, or this like mythical, exotic source of intrigue, and it becomes a literal site of excavation.
And I mean, it's kind of, I guess it's fascinating this week that we're going to be covering that, those issues across, you know, half a century of filmmaking, from Pasolini to the present day. So just a quick note before we get on to the reviews, a note to join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lines member. If you do so, you'll receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies, while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to our Steady HQ page for detailed breakdown of our plans. Also, just a little reminder that Little White Lies issue 95, The Decision to Leave issue, inspired by and a print shrine to the new film by South Korean director Park Chan-wook, is now available through our website and on the shelves of all good magazines sellers. So now, on to the movies. The Forgiven takes place over a weekend in the Moroccan desert and explores the reverberations of a random accident on the lives of both the locals and Western visitors to a house party in a grand villa. We've all been there. Marina, this film has it's notable. So it's, the film is directed by John Michael McDonough, who is the brother of the possibly a little bit more widely lauded and Martin McDonough of Three Billboards and the incoming Banshees of Inisherin fame. One of the films that I loved by John Martin McDonough was a film called Calvary from a few years back, but he seems to have been quite off the boil of late, and it feels quite notable that this film has completely bypassed the festival circuit. And maybe that's a bit of a leading question, but like, can you give us a bit of an overview of the film and maybe sort of an insight into why festivals might have veered away from this one?
Basically, in this film, Ralph Fiennes and Jessica Chastain are an unhappily married couple. They fly to Morocco to visit their friends Richard and Dali, played by Matt Smith and Caleb Landry-Jones, who are playing a happier couple, and they're throwing a big party in their vacation home, which is this like lavish, completely like showered in decadence, full of like servants. It's like a palace almost. On the way, a Moroccan boy with their car, and basically that boy is killed, and then that whole thing transpires into a dud, I would call it. I was just like asking myself throughout the whole film, like, who greenlit this? Because it's just so surface level in terms of its characterization, in terms of its like, it's trying so hard to critique Orientalism and it fails even harder. Did you guys think that?
Yeah, I think I also agree it's a little bit of a dud. And coming back to what we were just talking about, it is very clearly this white man trying to make a point about something he's not entirely familiar with, and maybe not even vaguely familiar with. And I also like Calvary, and it is a shame that he has never managed to repeat that kind of recipe of wit and just a very tight script. But sometimes I think it's also a cast that is suited to these characters, and even though we have quite a banging cast here, none of them are even near top form, and I think it's because of the script itself. But you have these little jokes, and not to spoil the film too much, but there's a moment when Ray Fiennes' character is confronted with having to kind of go into a space with these people, and he is just mentioning ISIS, and it's meant to be this throwaway line and to punctuate this moment there, but it just falls very flat. And Madonna does bring these characters in, the locals, to try and alleviate the whiteness and the foreignness of it all. And it never truly works. It feels really disconnected. It feels like these are these pawns walking around, these rich white people, and they are only there to complement their lines. Yeah, it felt very unengaging in general, I think.
Yeah, but what Hava was saying, that like it feels like the Arab just becomes like this one-dimensional narrative tool, not to aid like some crazy character arc or anything, but just to like point out to lazy satire. And it's not dumb enough to be fun or like bad enough to be funny.
I mean, the way it's described, you know, makes the film sound also like a kind of like that perhaps McDonough's interest is on a critique of capitalism and the kind of all that that implies. And I mean, the log line makes it sound a lot like the Tom Wolfe novel Bonfire of the Vanities, about the, you know, the rich city, New York City trader who runs over someone, and then like the kind of, I guess the sort of the way that this guilt suffuses his life and brings out all these terrible aspects of his person. And but it sounds like it's been placed in this sort of, you know, Orientalist context, and within these kind of quote unquote foreign climes to sort of push this idea of like there being a kind of inherent racist, exploitational aspect to capitalism and the rich. Is that an idea that came across in it? Is that something that gives the film any value?
I don't think so, because it has been done in so many different ways and in so many better ways. I think when you're approaching something that has been approached so very often, you don't need to reinvent the wheel, but you need to do something that makes the film seem like it has somewhat a reason to exist. And this just doesn't feel like it. I finished watching it, and an hour later, I couldn't remember the characters' names. I couldn't... It's true. Like, I couldn't remember what they did. I'm like, was this a fever dream? So I don't think it succeeds in that either.
It almost feels like it tries to cast a net that's so wide that absolutely every single element loses nuance and doesn't have enough breathing space to actually become something, let alone make any type of commentary.
And word around the campfire is that it's got an all-time awful ending. I mean, you don't need to go into what that ending is, but is there truth to the rumor?
Yes. Yeah.
It is. Okay. It's just not good, is it?
No, it's not good.
I quite like the fact that Josh, on his Little White Lies review, made a whole point of putting this against Babel, which, once again, we're going back to Iñárritu, and this is a film that, even though I don't think is a masterpiece, does this very competently. And the same cannot be said here, and the ending is a big point of difference between the two.
So let's jump on and do some scores for this. So we have a three-tier rating system in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect, each out of five. So Hafa, if you want to, do you want to take the lead on this one?
Yes. So in anticipation, I would say that every time Christopher Abbott is in something, it's at least a three. I am a massive Christopher Abbott fan, and I quite like Madonna, so it would have been a three for me. Enjoyment is, and I am so sorry to say this, but it's a flat one. I wish I was doing something else, which includes getting a vaccine, cleaning my house, going for my MOT. That any of that would have been a bit more fun. And in retrospect, that's a two, probably. Just not great. Sorry.
Marina.
So in anticipation, I would also go with three. In enjoyment, I would score a little bit higher than Hafa. I would go with a two because there's basically this whole ordeal with a little like Dalek toy. And I found myself just thinking, is Matt Smith in this like cinematic universe not the 11th Doctor? And if so, then 11th Doctor in this universe. So just because it prompted a different thought, I would go for two and probably two in retrospect as well.
Damning from both of you. So that is, it's okay. No, that's, we're here to be damning. It's called Truth in Movies, and that's why. Thank you very much, guys, for the Forgiven by John Martin McDonagh, which is out in cinemas on Friday.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Alethea Binney, a scholar, encounters a djinn who offers her three wishes in exchange for his freedom. Their conversation in a hotel room in Istanbul leads to consequences neither would have expected. So this is the new film by the great George Miller, one of Australia's greatest directors, certainly greatest living directors, known primarily for his Mad Max films and his kind of grand folly Mad Max Fury Road, which is many people's most beloved modern action film. But this is, and you know, if you look down his filmography, he isn't just a kind of action guy, and he doesn't just do kind of mainstream spectacle. He has done various other quite strange, more muted dramas. I mean, big fan of the Babe movies, especially Pig in the City, which has been a Little White Lies Truth and Movies film club in the past. Deservedly so. And he also has done weirder stuff like that movie Lorenzo's Oil with Nick Nolte, which I have seen but don't remember anything about. This maybe seems like it's something a little bit more on the in the wheelhouse of his kind of more muted dramas. But Hathor, can you give us a little, like, could you just give us a description of the vibe of this film?
Well, it's funny because I came out of this film and I told a colleague of mine, this could be called 3,000 Years of Longing or He's Just Not That Into You. And it's just, there's a lot of this, there's a lot of this film that I liked visually. And I think this is mostly because of the collaboration between Miller and John Seale, who was also the cinematographer of Mad Max Fury Road. But there's just this disconnection between Tilda Swinton and Idris Elba that, to me, if casting had been a little bit stronger, I think this film could have been 3,000 times better. But still, I fairly enjoyed it. It is, as we were saying in the synopsis, this woman who is a lonely but very settled scholar, and she has a penchant for knickknacks. And in one of her trips, she's giving a lecture in a different country, and she picks up this. It's not a lamp. It's a little bottle, and there she goes. This gin, and they go on this journey together. And George Miller just takes us to different times and different stories, and he's very good in storytelling. So I would say those snippets of the film when we get to be fully immersed on the world that he's creating are truly outstanding, especially if you're watching it on a big screen, which I would advise everyone to try and do. It's just everything that happens outside of that is simply not as strong, I would say.
So Marina, can I ask you, what if you could take up the lead there and just... Could you just describe the visual look of this film? Is it very effects heavy? And are Tilda Swinton and Idris Elba, are they just sort of like the sort of interstitial narrators, or are they actually in the stories?
So visually, well, just to start off by saying that I did really enjoy this. In terms of visually, I saw a tweet a couple of days ago by ScreenSlate that compared the film's visual look to like a 90s CD-ROM PC game. And I was like, that is definitely how this film should be experienced. I think structurally, it was a bit awkward and slapdash because the first kind of like two-thirds of the film, it's Idris Elba's Jin character kind of reflecting and like recollecting and sharing past memories and series of flashbacks. And then towards the end, it just becomes kind of unbalanced because then it kind of becomes rooted in the present. I think there was chemistry between Tilda Swinton and Idris Elba, but I don't think they were given much to work with in terms of their relationship. I wish it was a bit more like you could feel the passion. But, you know, even though I enjoyed this, when I sit to think about it, it does become a bit more murky when it comes to like this spectacularized glare, when it comes to myth and folklore that's tied to quote-unquote the Orient and how religion, culture, custom are kind of homogenized into this fiction and fantasy and masquerade. And also, what the hell is a professor of narratology? Is that a thing? Is that a real thing?
I don't actually know.
Yeah, but to be fair, I was reading a couple weeks ago that there's a whole class at a US university about Harry Styles. I think if you know about something enough, you can most definitely become a professor there, yeah. And just watch White Noise here, and Adam Driver is a Hitler studies professor. So, yeah, there's interesting things in cinema, professor-wise, I'd say.
And can I ask Hathor, like, one of the things that's interesting about this film and maybe quite radical is that, you know, it does take this sort of compendium-like structure where you have all these sort of short interwoven stories. Did you feel that there was a kind of strong arc that tied everything together, or was it was it a bit bitty for you?
Well, I think the first two acts feel very strong to me, even though I feel like at points the politics between the two of them and power dynamics are very skewed. I think that when we're out of the hotel room where they are confined in present time, and we go back to the past and we're just listening to Idris Elba and his wonderfully velvety voice tell us about the adventures he's been through, I think it's very beautifully done and beautifully interwoven, and there's a sense of claustrophobia. Even though this djinn is telling us about being some of the most important moments in history, he always goes back to this idea that he had to wait in between these periods, and he was in this bottle, and I felt particularly very claustrophobic. So I think this is very well done. And the cinematography is stunning. The special effects are stunning. It's truly, truly beautiful. It feels like you're into this fantasy and you're fully immersed. I just think that when you're out of this and you're back to the hotel room, and in particular the third act, when the two of them move out of their space altogether, it loses this magic. I wanted to keep in this fantasy. I wanted to be allowed a little bit more of that. And sorry, Marina, but I disagree. I think there was absolutely no chemistry between the two. So when we're out of this, I'm like, they don't want to touch each other. I don't think they want anything to do with each other. They're suffering from the Jessica Chastain, the forgiving syndrome of no sexiness whatsoever. It is very painful for me to see this romantic attempt when something platonic could have been beautifully done here. It could have been much more of her finding companionship in a different way, and I quite like the idea of a woman who's happy without it. It was very well established at the beginning, and she was so comfortable in saying, I don't need anyone, I love what I do, I am accomplished. It would have been great, and then we just veer back towards this relationship that to me felt beyond lukewarm.
The film has actually been out in the US and has been a bit of a disaster at the box office. And yeah, I wondered, does that make sense to you? Does that kind of scan for the type of film it is? Is it something that's maybe not got that kind of mainstream appeal to it, despite the fact that it has, you know, these, you know, relatively big stars and, you know, a big name director and lots of special effects? And
I don't think it was marketed correctly, to be honest with you, because I mentioned to a friend the other day that I'd gone to a screening of the film, and they were just like, I had no idea that that was coming out. So I do think it is a case of not marketing it properly.
Right. Okay. Well, let's get some scores on this one. Marina, let's go to you first this time. Anticipation, enjoyment, in retrospect, all out of five, please.
I think it's threes across the board for me. Mm-hmm. The one thing that I will remember from this film is the font that they used for the subtitles. I don't know who made that choice, but
that's going to be an extra mark for, that's probably going to be at an anticipation point for our editor Jake, who is very hot on typefaces. So
it's very nice. It's very nice unless you're dyslexic.
Yeah,
but yeah, other than that, it's very lovely. But anticipation for me, this was a solid four, perhaps even five. I love George Miller. I agree with you. I think Babe is a masterpiece. I think he's one of those directors who is just so bold and daring and unafraid to have fun with what he does. And I'm a big Tilda Swinton fan. I like fantasy films. I was very excited. Enjoyment-wise, I'll give it a three, only because of the relationship plot. I don't think this was nearly as strong as the rest, so it's a three. So in retrospect, this would be a nice round three for George Miller for me.
Perfect. That was 3,000 years of longing. And now, finally, to wrap things up, let's move over to Truth and Movies Film Club, which is Pier Paolo Pasolini's 1974 film Arabian Nights. In ancient Arabia, a beautiful slave girl chooses a youth to be her new master. Then she is kidnapped and they must search for each other. Stories are told within stories, love, travel, and the whims of destiny. So just to add a little bit of context before we start discussion, this is the final part of a trilogy that Pasolini made in the 70s. I don't know if he called it this, but it has since been termed the trilogy of life. It is kind of intended as, I guess, in the same way as the George Miller film, a joyful and affirmative and lusty look at storytelling in their ancient forms, and famously one that's quite kind of liberated in terms of its depictions of the human body and stories of a more kind of tactile corporeal nature, shall we say. All these films are, like, I guess they fit under, I mean, they're sort of borderline softcore in a way. They're, you know, they're definitely kind of for adult viewers. And I think that it's, you know, one of the things that I love about the movies is that, you know, Pasolini's very kind of open and not nonchalant about how he presents bodies and the both the male and female form in all their kind of glory. And as usual with his, I mean, one part of his kind of project since starting as a filmmaker has been a real kind of like the way he casts, the way he picks actors and presents faces and bodies is just he kind of goes against the kind of convention, what you'd sort of call the conventional definitions of beauty, and but that's not to say his films and the people in them aren't very beautiful in their own way. Finally, just to say, yeah, it's interesting to read that. So he made these films, and then they were actually quite big hits in Italy. Like a lot of people went to see these films and loved them, and not only that, it actually spawned a kind of movement in Italy where lots of people used these classical texts, like the Arabian Nights and previously the Decameron and Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, and they started this kind of mini movement in Italy of using these kind of bawdy tales from like medieval literature to make these movies about them, where the comprise of little vignettes. These films were definitely more softcore with a capital S, and marketed as kind of erotic movies. And apparently, Pasolini absolutely hated what he had spawned, being a kind of lifelong Marxist. He hated the fact that his films had kind of like spawned this capitalist beast. And he went on and disowned them. And then he made his kind of infamous swan song, Salò, after that, which is a graphic depiction of fascism, which, you know, maybe is a film club for another day. But maybe if we can start with you, Marina, can you tell us, what's your relationship with Pasolini? Was this a first time view? And what was your kind of like immediate take on the film?
So I'd seen Salò, but being aware of the trilogy of life, it's kind of interesting how he takes on the great books of the world literary canon that had at the time been sanitized to the extent of being presented as, you know, children's tales to a certain extent, and kind of re-injecting the sexuality and the physicality and the intimacy, but it doesn't have those blatant, like, oriental trappings that a film like 3,000 Years of Longing or The Forgiven does. It foregrounds the people as subject, and the women actually have agency and the men are completely stupid.
And Hafa, what about yourself? I mean, I know you managed to watch this while over in Venice, which must have been quite an experience for you.
It's funny because, and once again, pardon me, cinephiles, I had not watched this film before, and I watched it on my computer, and I downloaded it, I got a film, and I was going to watch it in the airplane on the way here. And I am so very glad that I did not. That would have been the most uncomfortable experience.
I would say that the airline would have probably banned you for life.
Yeah, can you imagine? I would not be allowed near children. I would probably be kicked out of, I don't know. I don't know what kind of words we can say in this podcast, but it was incredibly graphic. And so I'm glad that I watched in the comfort and the safety of my bedroom. So yeah, my relationship with Pasolini is not as extensive as I wish it was. I have watched quite a few of these films, of his films, but not all. I watched The Gospel According to St. Matthew, which I fairly like, and Teorema, which I like a fair bit as well. But this isn't necessarily my type of film. I'm sounding like I hate all films. I swear to God, I love films. I have a lot of fun with films, but I found it hard to connect with it. The story in itself is very interesting, and the way that Pasolini approaches his themes and the way that he moves between one central character to another, and he's telling this main love story through other characters' experiences, I found that engaging. But overall, I just wasn't entirely grabbed by it. I think that the thing that I like the most about it is, as you were saying, David, how freeing felt sexually. I think some of his other films have been less freeing and a bit more critical of religion, and in doing so, not perpetuating, but replicating some of the more conservative religious themes that we can see, or going the entire opposite way, being fairly over the top in his criticism of religion and other political themes. But here, there's this freedom with the body and sexuality and desire that feels so equal, so genderless. There is a naturality that in the first 20 minutes you're fairly taken aback. It is, as I said, fairly graphic, a lot of frontal nudity, but once you get to the rhythm of the story and what it does, it is a bit easier to engage with these notions of freedom and desire that he's presenting. I was fairly mesmerized by some of the acting, but in particular, the two main characters, especially the woman. I wish I could pronounce her name, but I think I will butcher this. But yeah, I thought it was beautiful. I thought the way that she moved and the way that she spoke and her giggle and the relationship that she built, the relationships that she built throughout, were a high point for me, most definitely. And to be a little bit at the end of it, there's a CGI, or not a CGI, special effects lion that they got me giggling for 35 minutes. At the end of it, I thought it was just so bonkers and interesting and visually, not deading, but visually ahead of its time, truly. So yeah, quite an experience.
The green screen lion, and then there's also a bit with the
oh my god, I screamed when I saw that lion. I screamed.
That's pretty awesome. I'm trying to think if I'm not sure that's something Pasolini has done often in his films, but I guess the necessity of, you know, if you want to include a lion in your film and it's 1974, then you know, green screen is probably the best way to do it.
But the scale, the scale is just, I felt so impossibly immature because I stopped the film and I'm like, oh my God, I need to appreciate this human-sized lion as an allegory at the end of this Pasolini film. I thought, yeah, I will remember this for years and years to come. So I'm really glad I watched it. And I agree with it. I think it is, out of the three, I think it is the one that is, that does the best job of approaching political and ethical themes. So this is a plus for me, I would say.
Yeah, I think the thing about the film, which is so interesting for me, is that Pasolini is using these stories not to critique the milieu in which the stories exist, but actually to critique contemporary, you know, modern Western society, and you know that the whole thing, like, and in fact the whole trilogy, part of its kind of, like, the ideas behind it is as a critique of sort of bourgeois conservatism, and you know, like, harking back to this time when people were free and liberal and expressive, and you know, I also think, like, part of the thing that I just absolutely loved about this film was just the little bits where you have these characters just walking around these incredible sort of stone cities and gorgeous muraled palaces and these little kind of huts that just have incredible crafted walls and trompe d'oeils and fabrics and paintings, and it's like, this is just the kind of, you know, this is a kind of found world for him. You know, it just feels for me that there's nothing kind of exploitative about it, or that at the very least he is kind of going to them and wanting to learn about what they can give him, rather than the opposite, trying to kind of impose his ideas on the landscape. But yeah, I mean, Hafa, like, to go on from your thing about watching on the airplane, I actually did watch this with my, I'd seen it a long time ago, and I just forgotten how much full frontal male nudity
David,
there is.
Are you going to say you watched this and your daughter was around? I'm terrified. No. This is where you go.
It was with my 75 year old mother in law, who's got quite kind of, you know, she's got good taste in movies, but yeah, this was a bridge too far. This one, the sheer amount of penis was too much, and it was the kind of very graphic castration scene that was the final straw. So
I will say, David, watching a man get castrated while sitting next to your mother-in-law, Pasolini is the gift that keeps on giving. The most awkward situations you can ever be in.
Calling Dr. Freud, indeed. On that painful note, we're going to wrap things up. As always, we want to hear your thoughts on any of the films we discussed this week. You can email truththemovies@tclondon.com or tweet us @LittleWhiteLies. Next week, David Cronenberg is back with more body horror in Crimes of the Future. Three's a Crowd in Claire Denis' Both Sides of the Blade. And in Film Club, it's 1987's splatter cult classic, Street Trash. And boy, is that a classic. Marina, Hafa, thanks so much for your amazing comments this week. Hafa, enjoy the rest of the festival. I believe we're going to be hearing you soon on one of our little Venice mini pods. So speak soon. All that leaves me to say is thanks very much for tuning in. And if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, David Jenkins, and my guests this week were Hafa Salas-Ross and Marina Asciotti. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Jake Cunningham.